I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Derek Lundy joins me now. He is the best-selling author of Godforsaken Sea, The Way of the Ship, and The Bloody Red Hand. He's got a new book out, Borderlands, Riding the Edge of America. I haven't finished it yet, but it's a book that looks at how Americans, as well as Canadians and Mexicans, view the borders that we share. It's also a wonderful adventure as Mr. Lundy rides the borders on his motorcycle. 15,000 kilometers he rides, and he explores issues of politics, security, culture, immigration, and history, among other things. As well as three of his close friends die, he looks at life, his own mortality, as he traverses the American-Canadian and American-Mexican borders. Borderlands is published by Knopf. The website for more is DerekLundy.com. He lives and rides on Salt Spring Island, but he joins me from Vancouver today. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Derek Lundy. Good morning, Mr. Lundy.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Did you ride over from Salt Spring Island?
No, I was a foot passenger on the ferry. I was very sedate.
Yeah. And so this bike that you took on this adventure, it was one bike, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And you still have it?
I do, yes. Yes, I use it for just transportation around the island these days.
Yeah. And how long have you had it?
I bought it in late 2005.
Used or new?
No, I bought it new, yeah. The KLR is probably, if there's listeners out there who ride bikes, they probably know about it. It's sort of a legendary machine in its category anyway.
Yeah. You mentioned in the prologue of the book the spate of gangland shootings here in Canada. Mm. What did the events of last year here and that violence mean?
Well, it meant that that events that were taking place in Mexico and along the Mexican border in connection with the drug cartels, the Mexican drug cartels' vicious war with each other and with the Mexican government, it meant that those sorts of events had their effect on us up here.
More so than usual?
Yeah, more so than usual, I think, because there are always connections. I mean, the drugs that we get up here originate in Mexico, or they're shipped from elsewhere through Mexico and then through the U.S. to us, sometimes directly to Canada, but usually through the U.S. But that connection, I think, is intensifying now, simply because of the Mexican government's war on the cartels, and because the cartels' business has been disrupted by that and by their internecine war, their war amongst themselves for control of the trade, which was really started or triggered by the Mexican government's campaign. All of those things have decreased the supply of drugs. And when you have decreased supply, you have increased competition for what's there. And Canadian drug gangs and dealers and so on fall into conflict as well as a result. So that spate of killings and shootings we had here last year, in fact, was quite explicitly traced back to the dearth of supply or the supply problems in the Mexican drug arena as well.
And it makes one wonder, that's a symptom, I suppose, of globalization and just continental, I guess, intercontinental dependence or whatever you call it.
Absolutely. It's sort of the criminal side of globalism, globalization, that's right. And interestingly enough, I mean, we think of borders as being, new borders in a globalized world as being sort of permeable membranes through which trade and people and goods and services can pass. And that's not happening with the U.S. borders. Of course, they're being hardened and defended and garrisoned in a way they haven't been for generations. But it's the criminals, the drug dealers, who are treating the borders as if they were true global borders or borders in an openly trading world.
Now, do you find that Canadians are conscious about the border?
I think Canadians are very conscious of the border. I mean, it's when we talk about the border, we really only mean one thing, don't we? We mean the U.S. border, and of course, it's what separates us from the United States. How do we define ourselves as Canadians? Well, we live north of the border, and the border is much more than even if it is a relatively open one, at least for the moment. It's still a very important line across the country, separating us from that great restless economic and military power to the south that we're forced to deal with, no matter what we, however much we'd wish not to.
And we're thinking of it more, simply because it's changing because of the American response after September 11th, right?
Exactly. I mean, 9/11 is the great watershed in border relations, and it just it changed irrevocably, I think, America's idea and Americans' idea of their borders and what the borders should be. And of course, one of the problems for Canada is this myth that will not die, that is held by a majority of Americans, more than 50%, that some or at least some of the 9/11 hijackers entered the U.S. from Canada. This isn't just conspiracy theorists who think this. This is a majority of Americans when they're polled, and it includes people like Janet Napolitano, the present head of Homeland Security, John McCain,
right.
Have all said at one time or another. I mean, they ultimately retracted the statements, but they all at one time or another said, "Yeah, that's what happened." It's just sort of, and of course that tremendously influences American attitudes towards the Canadian border and the attitude of the of both the Bush and Obama administrations too.
Do you find that Americans' regard of the border that it varies due to their proximity to it? Like, say, people that are closer to the border, whether it's in the north or the south, think of it differently than someone in middle America, say?
Yeah, that's a good question. To a certain extent they do, but not as much as you would think or as much as you think they should. Certainly if you live, very close to the Canadian border, if you live in one of the, if you live in Detroit or Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, if you live in those towns, obviously you have an awareness of Canada, which is quite different from someone living 500 miles south. On the other hand, studies have been done which show that when you poll or survey Americans in who live close to the border and Americans who don't live close to the border, and this applies to the Mexican as well to a certain extent, there are not that many differences really in what people know about Canada itself. People in Detroit may know Windsor, but they don't necessarily know much about Canada as a country, as a separate sort of political and social entity just to the north. So there's a surprising what surprises you really is the homogeneity of opinion, where you would expect it would be much more different depending on geography.
Now, you traveled both borders, the border that we have with the Americans and the Americans have with Mexico.
Right.
In terms of the difference between the two, is it one that's noticeable physically as well as in spirit?
Very much so. I mean, as you know, the southern border is becoming more and more fenced and walled and guarded and armored. There are about 700 odd miles or so of border fencing and walls now. That's on a 2,000-mile-long border. So that's a very substantial portion of it that has that physical barrier in place. Some of the fencing is old. It's been in place 10, 15 years, but a lot of it is very new, just installed in the last several years, again, as a response to the fears of 9/11 and to the continuing problem with illegal migrants and drugs and so on. So there's that tremendous physical presence in the southern border, and it's an area, the whole southern borderlands is flooded with armed agents of the state, Border Patrol, but also sheriff's deputies and various police departments and so on. So it's, you get a much different feel when you're down there than you do when you're riding the Canadian border, which, on the surface looks much the same as it always has. But one of the things that I discuss in the book is the way in which the Canadian border is changing, again, under this misapprehension that the United States has or that American governments have about the danger that Canada poses to them, but also simply because there's a tremendous impulse in the U.S. to treat both borders the same. Janet Napolitano recently said, the law says it doesn't distinguish between the Canadian and Mexican borders. The border is the border. So what we do in the South, we'll do in the North. Part of that is the American government doesn't want to be perceived as doing one thing for white Canadians and something different for, brown Mexicans. I mean, they don't want to be accused of racism by Hispanic American voters. But on the other hand, they really do perceive Canada as a threat. So increasingly, the Canadian border is no longer an undefended border. That's over and done with. And if you want to see the future of the Canadian border over a long period of time, look to the south. It is being fortified. It is being armed and armored, and various forms of virtual surveillance are being installed, drones, cameras, motion detectors, that sort of thing. So increasingly, the Canadian border is looking more like the Mexican border. It'll take a long time to happen, but I think that's the way that's going. That's just something we'll have to get used to.
When you were down south, you spent some time with some Minutemen, right?
Right.
This is something that if you watch Fox News, as I occasionally do, you know who they are, but most people don't know who they are. Who are they?
Well, the Minutemen are a kind of vigilante organization. They're in a long line of state of the private militias or sort of armed or vigilante groups that have grown up and died away and withered away in the United States for generations now. The original Minutemen, of course, were the Revolutionary War's militia in Massachusetts, who had to be ready to jump to arms at a minute's notice, hence the name. But it's been used before in the 1960s. There was an offshoot of the John Birch Society, which called itself the Minutemen. They actually, conducted some bombings and shootings before they sort of collapsed under the weight of their own paranoia and idiocy. The current Minutemen are a much more viable organization because they have a real issue to address, and that is the flood of illegal migrants across the Mexican border. So that's been the focus of their efforts, to secure the borders and to, in effect, force the American government to do what they think it has an obligation to do, which is to enforce the law no matter what the consequences are. So they're in the current Minutemen are in a long line of these sort of self-help armed militias or armed organizations that have grown up and then ultimately withered away for generations in the United States.
How do the Mexicans view the border? I mean, is it something that they think that they need to penetrate, that they need to get across?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think the Mexican attitude towards the border is very ambivalent. For ordinary Mexicans, for poor Mexicans, the border is a thing to get through, to get to, el otro lado, the other side, where there's work and jobs and some sort of economic security, a chance to start a new life. And, of course, hence the illegal migrants who flood across the border, fewer of them now with security measures and the recession and so on, there's less demand for their labor, but they certainly see the border as just something to get across. The Mexican government has a much more ambivalent view. On the one hand, they know they have to cooperate with the United States in securing the border and trying to slow down, at least, the flood of immigrants, trying to control the terrible, vicious drug wars that are going on in Mexico along the border. But at the same time, there are suspicions on the American side that the Mexicans aren't really trying hard enough, that the border represents a kind of safety valve. The Mexican government has failed quite spectacularly to look after a large percentage or a significant percentage of its population in terms of giving them, jobs and economic security and a decent standard of living. And so the United States is a kind of safety valve. These people can leave and get across the line, and then they're no longer a Mexican problem. In fact, they send money back to relatives in Mexico. It's a huge source of foreign exchange or foreign income for Mexico. So there's a real ambivalence, I think, on the part of Mexico about it. And, of course, there's a historical fact that the entire U.S. Southwest, all of the, Texas right across to California, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, was all Mexican territory at one time, and it was taken from Mexico in the mid-19th century after an aggressive and unjustified U.S. war against Mexico. So, there's a sense that, this used to be our land, and it was taken from us unjustly. And when we flood the land with our own people, legal or illegal, we're kind of, in a sense, taking it back, a kind of demographic reconquest.
I'm talking to Derek Lundy about his new book, Borderlands, Riding the Edge of America. It's published by Knopf. These three friends of yours who passed away, Mike, Chris, and Will, would they have done this if they were alive? Would they have gone on a motorcycle with you?
I think one of them would. I think Will would have. He was a boat builder and a sailor and quite an adventurous guy. So, it's something he would have certainly thought about doing. The other two, Mike and Chris, no. They were real city boys, and I doubt they would have. I think they would have admired it and thought it was a neat thing to do, but they wouldn't have done it themselves.
Yeah, and so their deaths came pretty close to one another, right?
They did. They took place within a period of about 15 months. Just one of those terrible coincidences that life sometimes holds, I guess.
What's that line in the book from Mailer?
In motion, a man has a chance.
Yeah, and so that led you to do this?
Well, it was certainly one of the motivations. I mean, I'd finished my previous book, and I was looking around for an idea for another one. And I was interested in the borders. I come from Northern Ireland, where, you know, the border with the Republic of Ireland has been a very important thing for a long time. And the Irish only recently stopped killing each other over it, and other issues as well. So I was interested in borders and thought it would be an interesting and good thing to write about. But the idea of going by motorcycle, I think, was in part because I thought it would lend, you know, some added narrative interest to the book, but also because I think from a practical point of view, people react to you differently on a motorcycle, and you get to places you can't necessarily get to in a four-wheeler. It's a much different experience. You're exposed to the weather, to the elements. That becomes part of the story as well. So, you know, all of that, I think, seemed to make it a much more dramatic possibility.
And the landscape that you could traverse on a motorcycle rather than in a car.
Exactly. I mean, it's a much different experience, isn't it? I don't know if you ride a motorcycle, but perhaps many of the people who listen to this will know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's a completely different experience. Obviously, you're out in the open. People can see you. Every day I would have quite a few conversations with the Border Patrol along the Mexican border who wanted to know what the hell I was doing down there close to the border. But it was quite a different experience with them because I was on a bike rather than in a vehicle, enclosed in a car. They could see me. They could see I wasn't carrying weapons. They interacted with me, I think, quite differently. And many of them are guys who rode bikes themselves. And so after the initial unpleasantries were taken care of, I actually had some interesting personal conversations with some of them.
What would you pack? I mean, you obviously have to pack light, right?
Well, no, actually, the KLR is, you know, one of its great virtues is that you can really lug a lot of gear. So I had about 90 pounds of gear. I had spare parts, tools, camping gear. I was completely self-sufficient. I camped out a few times. You know, the clothes that you need, riding the desert or riding up in the north in the early spring, it got very cold, very wet, so you had to carry a lot of clothing of various kinds as well, my armored riding gear. So it's actually a lot of stuff to take, and I had to be as self-sufficient as possible if the bike broke down, even though it's a notoriously reliable machine. If it did happen, I had to be prepared to deal with it myself if I was in the middle of nowhere. So I actually did pack quite a lot of gear, and the KLR, again, can do that. It can carry it.
Well, what did you learn about yourself, if anything?
Well, I learned that I was capable of at the age of 60 or so, of sitting in the saddle for 8 to 10 hours a day, day after day, for weeks, which was kind of a good feeling. I felt that I kind of toughened up, and my body, aging as it is, responded reasonably well to that physical challenge anyway. But I also, of course, it was an adventure, and like any adventure, it challenges you. It's not necessarily fun, but it's when it's over, even if you're glad it's over, you're still very glad you did it. So the time alone, I think, was useful. Just the process of gathering material for another book in that particular challenging way, I think, was useful. I guess when you get to be 60 years old, you feel you pretty much know yourself anyway. So I'm not sure I added a great deal to my, to my intimate self-knowledge in that sense. But certainly, the adventure and the challenge is always something that stretches you. And in that sense, yeah.
A lot of right-wingers who come on the program talk about seeing greater continental security plans, integration, and the sort. Mm-hmm. You talked already about sort of these physical things that we're seeing on the borders now. Do you suspect that down the line that there will be some sort of, tri-national or whatever you want to call it, body looking after the borders?
That's always a possibility, but I think it's unlikely.
Do you think that it'll be exported to the Americans then?
Well, I think that the American position now is that, we are going to look after our own borders. We're not going to enter into any security arrangement with Mexico, God knows, because they just don't have the infrastructure or perhaps even the will to help us out much. But we're not even, they're saying, the Americans are saying, we're not even going to enter into any kind of continental or northern continental security arrangement with Canada either, because we just don't trust them enough. You know, the lingering effects of the 9/11 myth that the hijackers entered the U.S. from Canada. You know, there's all kinds of Muslims in Canada, not many in Mexico. So, of course, that community, in the American view, presents problems, a potential problem of homegrown terrorists. So the Americans are unlikely, I think, to enter into any cooperative arrangement with their neighbors. I think that they will continue to secure, certainly, the southern border, and increasingly, and in similar ways, they will try to secure the northern border as well. They will shut us out as much as they can, congruent with, you know, trade and reasonable passage of goods and people and so on carrying on. That's if nothing happens. I mean, if there is any kind of terrorist attack in the U.S., which has any kind of Canadian connection, then all bets are off.
Did you see Ronald Wright often on Salt Spring?
Yes, he's a friend of mine, actually.
Yeah, because somewhere in the press material that I got sent from your publisher, it says that his book, which he was on this program for when that came out a couple years ago, would be a good companion with this book.
Absolutely, I think that's right. I mean, Ron and I are friends, and we often talk about this sort of thing in pubs and loud voices. I think they're probably, they are companion pieces in a way, I think, that's right. And Ron himself, completely under my influence, has once again bought a motorcycle, and he used to ride when he was younger, and has become an even more avid rider than me.
So, really?
Yeah. Entirely my influence.
Yeah, well, what's next for you?
Well, the book that I'm working on now is another sea book. I've written two of those previously, Godforsaken Sea and The Way of a Ship, and I'm returning to those themes or some of the themes that I talked about in those two books. It's perhaps increasingly I'm seeing this third book as the third book of a kind of trilogy in a way, but it'll be about the sea and our changing ideas of it and its changing meaning for us, among other things.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you today, Derek. I was reminded the other day that I did read the last book on Ireland.
Right.
I can't remember anything from it, but I do.
The Bloody Red Hand.
Yeah, The Bloody Red Hand, yeah. This is a very thoughtful and important book. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much, Joe. Great pleasure.
You're welcome. The website for more is DerekLundy.com. The book is called Borderlands, Riding the Edge of America. It's published by Knopf. It's author Derek Lundy on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.